thanks to the more than 1,000 listeners who donated to our end of fiscal year campaign. We still have limited quantities of thank you gifts in stock. If you've not yet donated, consider making a contribution of $8.50 a month. We'll say thanks by sending you a Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins mug. Learn more and donate at 704-549-9000 or online at WFAE.org. And thanks. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. They're called food deserts, places where access to grocery stores and the fresh, healthy food they contain is limited to non-existent. In Charlotte, 90,000 people live in food deserts, up 20% from 2010. These deserts are located in areas where residents are living at or near the poverty level. Their only options when it comes to buying food is at convenience stores, gas stations, and at fast food establishments. This lack of food security doesn't speak well for a city already at the bottom of rankings of upward mobility, and we'll talk about that. But there are people working to change this, and we're going to spend the hour talking with them about the problem and some potential solutions. Dimple Ajmera is a Democrat on Charlotte City Council at large. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Zach Wyatt is director of the Carolina Farm Trust. What's that? We'll find out. Good morning and welcome.
Thanks, Mike. I appreciate having us on.
And you're welcome. And Philip Altianoburo, oh, I did it wrong. Philip Altianoburo is assistant professor of biology and director of the Center for Renewable Energy and Sustainability at Johnson C. Smith University. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. If you'd like to join our conversation as we go through it, you can join us at Charlotte Talks. Email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks, and you can watch us on Facebook Live. We've talked about food deserts in the past on this program over the years, and every time we do, the number of people living in these food deserts grows. It's not getting smaller, It's getting bigger. Is that a function of the fact that more people are falling into poverty or having to move into those areas? The fact that we have more people moving to Charlotte, so the population is increasing? Or is it because the number of available grocery stores in areas other than South Park and Uptown and South End is decreasing? What's the answer to that question?
Well, I mean, I think it's important to define what a food desert is and the food desert is and food insecurity. I mean, food desert is very much geographically based, and food insecurity is really, it doesn't matter where you are, it's more of where you fall on the socioeconomic ladder. And that doesn't affect geography. So you can be living in South Park with an apartment with all your kids in it, and you still can't walk down the street to that Whole Foods and buy food.
Who can?
I mean, it's a hard challenge for all of us, and really on a food desert level, we all live in a food desert if we don't have a car, and we all live in a food desert if those trucks stop delivering those groceries to the grocery store. So that's kind of where, with Carolina Farm Trust, really what we're trying to do is kind of build these local food systems back. So if we have to rely on a local food system, we can. The current geopolitical climate, all the talks around NAFTA, it seems that we need to take responsibility on where our food comes from.
But there are, quote-unquote, food deserts in Charlotte. They've been identified as such. I think in the 2015 State of the Plate report that Charlotte did, they identified, I think, the West Boulevard corridor between Billy Graham and 485, the Brookshire Boulevard corridor between 85 and 485, Albemarle Road between 485 and the county line. Zip codes 28205, 206, 208, 212, and 217 are all technically food deserts, which means what? There are no grocery stores in those areas. None.
Yes, so it is a timely discussion because we just received a draft of the food system study that was done by a consultant and local experts that shows that our region underperforms in every category when it comes to food production and sales. Hundreds of millions of dollars leaves our economy because the food is not grown and produced here. Well, that's going to change now, and I'll cover that with some of the policies changes that we are looking into, and also some of the initiatives like supporting what Zach is doing with Urban Farm Trust.
Okay. These food deserts are a long-term problem, but food insecurity can come and go. It really is dependent on your personal economic situation, right?
I'd say that's definitely one of the strongest indicator. Poverty is one of the strongest indicator for food insecurity, although it's not the only one, of course. But believe it or not, most poor families are not food insecure. And 60% of food insecure families are poor.
So explain that. That's my head's going to explode.
Yeah. So food insecurity is a complex phenomenon. Mm-hmm. It's not just about, access to shopping opportunity. It's also availability of items in your grocery store. It's also a factor of, how accessible these places or shops are where you can get full-service produce. Now, when it comes to poverty, being complex as it is, a lot of households that are poor actually get assistance through federal assistance, nutrition assistance programs. Mm-hmm. So some of them utilize these programs and, they're able to provide for their household needs as far as food is concerned. But then there's a large population as well that does not have access to these programs. And therefore, you have a lot of, poor families that are going without food. They're actually teetering on the brink of hunger. Kids are going to school without, adequate nutrition.
A lot of these food deserts, most of the children, if not all of the children attending school, are on free lunch.
That's right. That's right. And, that range ranges considerably between 0% and 100%, mm-hmm. because they're, of those satisfied households that, can get nutritional assistance. Not all of them actually take it up.
But even if you get nutritional, even if you fall into that economic bracket where you can get economic assistance for purchasing food, you can't buy that food if there's no grocery store or if you have no way to get to the nearest grocery store.
That's completely correct.
Everybody eats. That means everybody has to visit a grocery store at some time, several times usually during the week. Even low-income residents have to eat. So why don't the economics work out so that grocery stores, chains, full-service grocery stores, not convenience stores that sell Snicker bars and fried chicken, mm-hmm. why doesn't the economics work for these chains to put some kind of a store in areas where these food deserts exist?
Well, economics, right?
I don't get
they're
it.
In, they're in for the money, right?
Well, yes, but people have to go to the store and buy it.
Exactly.
And they need to buy it. They're going to buy it at the convenience store, and they're going to pay a lot more for it at a convenience store, and it's not going to be healthy food. Why isn't it economically justifiable to put a grocery store in those
areas?
Well,
if you even look at the margins that, I live up near the lake. There's a grocery store that's further into the lake than mine, and that is a couple cents more expensive than the grocery store I go to. Same thing, it's 2 miles away, but there's just an uptick, on certain products. So if they're not going to go into a low-income area and then having to, they're going to go where the margins are. That's kind of what I would, it's a common sense thing to me, and I think from Dimple and Dr.
Well, you're certainly not going to find a Whole Foods there. You're not going to find probably a Publix or even a Harris Teeter, but what about Lidl? What about, what's the other low-cost?
Aldi.
Food Lion.
Aldi, yes, Food Lion. Why aren't they there in some form? Why isn't Walmart there in some form?
I think it's a combination of economics and also farmers market we have to look at. In Charlotte, only 1 in 7 farmer markets accept EBT cards, and nationally that number is 1 out of 3.
And why is that?
I think the recent study shows that that's just the way the structure has been. And we have to change that.
Meaning that it's difficult for them to get payment from the government at a farmer's market as opposed to a grocery store. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yes.
Also, I'd like to add that there's also competition. These smaller stores have to compete with the bigger stores, the chain stores. And these chain stores are selling their products at 10 to 40% less than the smaller stores. They're knocked out of business just that way.
Although we did a show on this a couple of years ago, and I remember, I think it was somebody from the city, it could have been from the county, I can't remember. They launched a program in which they went to various convenience stores and asked them if they mm-hmm. would sell fresh produce in uh-huh. just a section of the store, and they found a way to supply that produce. Is that still underway, and does it work?
I'm pretty sure it's underway. I mean, Elliot Royal over the health department and John Levin, I mean, we've kind of talked about that, and I think it's been very successful from what I understand.
It's called the Healthy Corner Store Initiative.
Okay.
And, the idea is to bring, fresh, affordable produce to corner stores because that's what dots most of these mm-hmm. Economically distressed neighborhoods. Yes, so it's been in operation for, I think, about a year now. With mixed success, of course, because there also has to be a culture change, among the residents that use these corner stores. They're not expecting to find fresh produce there, and for the corner store owner, they're concerned about whether they're actually going to sell everything that they buy. I don't believe that they do.
Because if you're raised in an environment where you never see a fresh vegetable, you don't know what it is. If you're raised in an environment where you really spend your meal time at McDonald's or uh-huh. Burger King or one of the fast food places, if it's not a French fry, you don't know it as a vegetable.
There has to be education around it.
Right.
And that's kind of where the urban farm at Aldersgate is so critical, is because there is a large part of the population that doesn't know where their food comes from. They don't know how hard it is. And they don't know what to do with it.
Why does it matter that people know where their food comes from?
Because you appreciate it, and you know what it is. I mean, I've had countless conversations with people where kids just think it just shows up at the grocery store. It doesn't. I grew up on 300 acres up in Northern Virginia. I mean, it's kind of, I lived in that environment, and wherever you kind of live and grow up, that's your kind of common sense.
So you have to see it. Yeah, Johnson C. Smith University identify that need of the community. You're providing fresh produce to the community, and you're telling them to figure it out. What do you do with it? So, last year we published a book. Johnson C. Smith University did published a book, a cookbook that actually takes recipes and stories about the relationship of community members to food as they were growing up, and put it together in an accessible cookbook. So you have several recipes that take between 5 to 7 minutes to prepare. Mm-hmm. And that's available to residents when they attend the farmer's market. They can purchase one of those. The proceeds from that book ends up going to the community, 100%. So not only are we building that local capacity, but we're also preserving the stories that the community has and identifies with cooking. It's called Roots, Cultivating Culture.
I should point out that the Philip Otienoboro is here from Johnson C. Smith, and they do have this program that he just alluded to at Johnson C. Smith to help provide produce and understanding of what that produce is all about. We're going to talk more about that program as we go through this show. And Zach White is here from the Carolina Farm Trust. They're doing something similar on the east side of town. We're going to come back and talk more about that and more about food deserts, because there are other things about food deserts that people don't understand. As they're listening, okay, you live in an area where there is no grocery store, so why don't you just go take yourself and go and buy groceries someplace else? Well, that's pretty difficult for a lot of folks, and we'll tell you why when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFA. It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about food deserts, food insecurity, and we'll get to some solutions that are going on, or attempted solutions that are going on around the area. Dimple Ajmera here. She's City Council at Large with us in our Spirit Square studio. Zach Wyatt is Director of the Carolina Farm Trust, and Philip Otianoburo is Director of the Center for Renewable Energy and Sustainability at Johnson C. Smith University. And they run they've started a program called Sustainability Village, which we will talk about as we go through this. A lot of the people who live in food deserts, a lot of these people in low-income areas are forced to go to convenience stores, which we all know are maybe convenient, but they're more expensive, and they don't have a wide array of food products there. Certainly not one you can build a healthy, balanced diet on in most cases. The other places they turn to are gas stations, which we also know are not food stores. They're gas stations that have snack foods. And, of course, fast foods. We have in this country an obesity epidemic. Is there a greater incidence of obesity in these food deserts because of the foods that these folks are forced to eat?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, when you only have access to, you know, a fast food chain or, you know, your corner store, I mean, that's all you're going to be able to eat. It's a multi-layered problem. And that's kind of where putting back urban farming into a population like Charlotte, and putting it right in the middle of an area that is considered a food desert is really important, because it brings people back into a conversation that I think that we've all been kind of left out of, and it's something that they can understand, and we need to make it very approachable to them. We're wanting to put a commercial kitchen on the property. Rosa Parks Farmers Market, which is on West Trade Tuesdays 3 to 7. Has done a great job bringing in a chef Kabui from the Triangle every week to do cooking demos. And that's just critical, because if you haven't used produce before, what are you supposed to do with it? And Chef Kabui does an amazing job of really kind of explaining to it, getting things from the different vendors that are at the market, and transforming it into this amazing meal. And we need to multiply that all over the city. That's critical, and Dr. Otamura can speak to more of it.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, in addition to health benefits, we are also looking at cleaner air, because average food travels over 4,000 miles to get to the grocery store. So when we talk about emission reduction, cleaner air, I think it is very important that we also take more sustainability from clean air and clean water perspective.
So what you're saying is the food that is locally grown is better for the environment. It's also better for you because it's fresher and more nutritious.
Could I also say about the profile of a food insecure household? 81% of these households depend on energy-dense diets, their selection is quite limited. So if you're thinking about obesity, then having these energy-dense diets, the fast food type diet, definitely, increases the the level of obesity in these homes.
So this becomes a public health issue, and I know that the county, Mecklenburg County, is the entity that deals with public health, not so much the city of Charlotte. But is there something that the city of Charlotte, or in combination with the county, can do or should be doing to address this?
Absolutely, and we are taking a comprehensive look at our policy. In fact, when I had met with farmers recently, they all had brought up how we do not have protection in place for our farmland. And they all had talked about we are one of the only 15 counties in the state where we do not have VAD. VAD is a voluntary agricultural district.
What's that?
It's a state statute.
What does it stand for?
It's a VAD. VAD.
What does that mean?
It's Voluntary Agricultural District.
Okay, great. Thank you.
It's allowed by state statute to have agricultural designation that provides farm protection. So as we revamp our UDO process, we are looking at...
UDO is?
Is Unified Development Ordinance.
Okay.
And as we revamp the UDO process, we are looking at incorporating VAD.
And UDO is a way to a new a way to look take a fresh look at zoning and what can be in a certain area at a particular time in space.
Absolutely, because our current zoning ordinance was written in 1992.
Right.
So it hasn't been changed since then. We never had the protection of farmland in place. So we are going to change that. And our planning director and I have had conversations on this. So he's looking forward to incorporating VAD, which provides the protection that is necessary to provide more incentives for our farmers. We currently have over 230 land parcels in the county that could qualify for VAD and even potentially more.
And this land that used to be farmland in some cases is being gobbled up by development and sprawl, and that's why bringing in urban gardens is a good idea, because not only do you show people where their food comes from, it's fresher, it's nearby, and is it less expensive then?
I wouldn't call it. I mean, in a certain, I mean, it depends where you tackle in all the costs. I mean, there are so much layers as far as, again, with Dimple, with, you know, carbon emission, you know, trucking all of our produce from 4,000 miles away. And then you have to look at supply chain, you know, looking at the city as a whole. You know, if rail trucking or shipping stops, we don't eat. You know, we have no access. I mean, and that's just so a bizarre statement to kind of really think about.
The 21st century infrastructure had better keep working, because none of us know how to do anything.
Absolutely. And so the main point that, as far as Carolina Farm Trust is concerned, is from the urban farm, and we're going to really highlight the urban farming to make sure that the public in urban centers understand how important our rural farms are.
Yeah.
And those rural farmers really are kind of the backbone of what I see as a future of being a food secure Charlotte, a food secure county, and a food secure region. I mean,
critical. I do think that local food is cheaper. You know, if you think about the environmental impact of transporting food.
Flying and trucking strawberries to Charlotte in December from wherever they come from is expensive.
And they don't taste good either.
Yeah.
And I think there is also an economy component to it, where currently we have hundreds of millions of dollars leaving our region could potentially be here, because we can potentially grow and produce our food here.
But one of the problems is, and we did a show on this too, about farmers markets. You would look at, if you go to a farmers market, you think, man, this is working great. This farm to table thing is working great. Look at all the produce we have in these farmers markets. But the truth is, and you just said this off the air, Zach, that it's hard to supply these farmers markets because there are not enough farms anymore. And in previous programs that we've done on this, it was also revealed that a lot of people don't want to be farmers. The economic insecurity of that, your dependence on the weather, the difficulty of the work is not appealing to a lot of people.
Especially small farmers.
And that's the reason we even need more protection for our farmers and our farmland. We just cannot save the land. We have to save farmers.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what study says, that we have to save our farmers. For an example, if we put VAD in place, we are providing that additional protection that they never had. So when I met with the farmer, they had said, if there is a nuisance, if there is nuisance, it gives this additional protection from lawsuits. If there is a development that's going next to the farmer, next to farmland, it could provide that additional protection that we do not have. So that's why it's very important that we also look at initiatives, but then we also look at our policy and how can we create a policy that is more effective and that serves our 21st century.
Could I say that these protections are available, only they are targeted mostly to larger growers. That's what the Farm Bill actually has. It has crop loss protection, you know, worked into the, $100 billion budget, the Farm Bill. And, you know, besides having, you know, supplemental nutritional assistance tied into it, but, you know, you have a system that actually takes care of the big farmers. Now, when it comes to small urban farmers, that's where you have much less protection. That's where you have.
And that's kind of where Carolina Farm Trust is trying to play a role in, you know, the countless conversations I have with, you know, Joe and Danny Rowland, for example. I mean, they do an amazing job.
And who are they?
They're from Roland Row Farm up in Gold Hill. They're at the Davidson Farmers Market, the Matthews Farmers Market. You know, and part of, you know, the main part of our mission with Carolina Farm Trust is to try. Business 101 doesn't work in the small farming community. So it's really there trying to get them what they need to be successful so we have a food system that works, but also to try to give them a quality of life that is normal or somewhat normal. They can't go on vacation. I mean, they have chickens, they have laying hens, and it's very hard for them to, hey, let's go on a week vacation. Well, they need someone to come and, right, and take care of everything. So but there are a lot of population that wants to go into being a farmer, but it's very difficult and almost impossible if you're not really born into it. And that's another thing that we're trying to work on.
I want to get back to these food deserts and people who live in them and the difficulties that they face in finding, even if they want and understand how to use fresh produce, the difficulty in obtaining that for them. WBTV did a story about this. Diedrich Russell, our colleague over there, reported on the plight of those living in food deserts and spoke to one resident who said that most of us are traveling 10 miles to go to an upper-tier grocer so we can have healthy fruits, veggies, baked goods, and steamed seafood. She wasn't specific about what she meant by upper-tier grocery store, but or grocer.
Chains.
But for people who are working two jobs, for people who are without a car in many cases, to go to a grocery store a mile or two or three away to get your groceries becomes a full-time job almost on that day.
Mm-hmm. That's
because
right.
You're waiting on the bus. That trip may be 45 minutes to an hour or more. You go grocery shopping. You can't buy frozen stuff because the trip back is going to be 45 minutes to an hour or more. Or you take a cab or you Uber back. And if you do that, that's an additional expense on a lower income person.
That's right.
They really can't do this, can they?
No, they cannot. And that's why they become food insecure. Availability, accessibility, and affordability. If you cannot access your food, and that's healthy food, you are going to become food insecure.
How many farmers markets are in these areas, or close to these areas, or within easy travel distance, either by bus or on foot or a bicycle or whatever, to these food deserts?
Not enough.
Not very many.
Well, and again, I mean, I think we're trying to put too much pressure on a farmer's market to fill this problem. It's not. You know, farmer's markets are open typically just once a week, you know, on Saturdays or, you know, Tuesday afternoon. And what are the lower economic people are typically working. You know, so you know, the farmer's markets are always going to be a very kitschy thing. They're very community oriented, that people really like to go. It's a community kind of center place. And that hits a certain demographic that likes to do that. It's not going to hit a large rank and file population. And that's kind of where kind of bringing the urban farms back in. You know, and it's every industry right now is going through a revolution pretty much. You know, the food is the same way. And what we want to try to figure out with the urban farm at Aldersgate is, yes, we'll have a farm stand there to address, you know, the mile and a half, the people that live from there. But what are we going to do for the people that are outside of that? And that's where I really think we can create a delivery model where we're hitting different apartment complexes and putting a package together that has the basics to get people into a more food secure area that's convenient for them.
So let's delve a little deeper, because you've talked about your organization very peripherally here since we started this conversation, because I haven't asked you about it yet.
Right.
The Carolina Farm Trust, you're at Aldersgate, which is a senior living center, and they've given you for $1 a year, I believe, some adjacent land to their property that had gone unused, and you are turning it into an urban farm. The principal goal of the Carolina Farm Trust, according to your website, is to significantly increase the availability of health, fresh food grown, distributed, and eaten locally. You're on the east side of town. How does that food get to the west side of town?
Got to get it there. I mean, by a car, I think with... there's just a lot of opportunity to serve the east side, but this is a project that we hope that is a broader vision for the entire city. So it's really working with what we can on the east side, working with Dr. Underbrew with the doing a sustainability village, and really trying to create these boxes that we're going to, you know, we've been looking at different wellness programs and what can we do to put a dozen eggs, some sort of meat together and some produce that they want. You know, it's not just bok choy and mustards and beets and turnips. I mean, what do they want? What are they familiar with? And, you know, and get it to them on a weekly basis. You know,
and definitely bring it to the farmer's market.
Right.
Yeah.
And then with the, you know, with the urban farm, you know, it gives them an opportunity to kind of come and get more a relationship back to food. But it's also workforce development and really pulling all the social capital that we possibly can from it.
This is your first location?
Yes. I mean, we're 3 years old. We've been really selling a vision for the last 3 years, and we are very proud of the leadership Aldersgate has taken to give this an opportunity to us, but the responsibility is very high to make this work.
Are there plans to have more than one location once this gets underway?
Absolutely. I mean, the floodgates are starting to open as far as other organizations and other landowners wanting to.
How much land do you need for an urban effective urban farm?
I think it doesn't. The land size is not as important as the organization around how to use it. You know, we have 6.7 acres with this parcel in East Charlotte. You know, if you know, we had a great speaker, Bree Arthur, that went to our Night for the Museum fundraiser that really wrote a book called Foodscape Revolution that talks about turning traditional landscapes into foodscapes, which is something we really want to implement. You know, so it's, you know, putting garlic or rye down the greenways. It's using 600-700 square feet to do something with. You know, the parcel isn't the issue. It's what we do with it, how we manage it, and how do we organize it.
And who farms it?
What we're hoping to do is utilize the urban farm at Aldersgate as a first stepping stone for us to. We have a farm manager we've identified. We're very excited. Hopefully we can get some.
But are these paid staff? Are these volunteers from the
community?
Absolutely.
It's going to be a very balanced approach from paid staff. You know, working with workforce development, interns. I mean, we have been having great conversations with Jody Francisco, who's the new culinary director over at Geringer. We've talked to Tom Warshire about their intern programs. You know, so we want to.
He's with the city, by the way.
Yeah. So it's basically utilizing every possible social capital we can from these from the urban farm aspect.
How does an urban farm such as the one you've set up at Aldersgate?
We haven't even broken ground yet.
Let me ask the question.
To
all
be
right,
clear,
as the one you are setting up.
Yeah.
How does it differ from these neighborhood gardens that have cropped up in places where the neighbors in the neighborhood mm-hmm. plant their own crops mm-hmm. and harvest their own crops? How does it differ from that?
Well, it differs because we're going to be our goal is production. The community gardens are awesome, and we will complement them and we will hope to support them. But the community gardens are for people who want to grow their own food and harvest it and take it back. This farm is going to be production for the entire community.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll come back and talk more about that and about the operation at Johnson C. Smith as well. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about food deserts, food insecurity, how to tackle that problem of bringing healthy, nutritious food to low-income folks in areas that are not served or are underserved by grocery stores. Dimple Ejmyra is here. She's city councilwoman at large. Zach White is director of the Carolina Farm Trust. They'll be opening an urban farm at Aldersgate on the east side of town. How far away are you from doing that?
We have a lot of money to raise. I mean, the first phase is $600,000, which will really get at the infrastructure.
Well, stop.
Yeah.
I'm going to ask you about that right now, but I want to introduce also Philip Otienoboro, who is a director of the Center for Renewable Energy and Sustainability at Johnson C. Smith, and they've started something called Sustainability Village, which I'm going to talk about. You've been working on the urban farm, I'm coming back to Zach now, for a couple of years. Why does it take $600,000 to start a farm?
Well,
when you're being given the land.
Well, because the infrastructure is really expensive. Right now it's an old pool and tennis court facility. We
got to rip all that out.
There's telephone poles, fencing. We got to rip all that out. Dirt is not good. We're going to go bring in the dirt. We're not going to spend 3 years trying to get the soil into a usable position. So, I mean, the dirt is $55,000. But we're going to go get the best dirt because we don't have time. I mean, we don't have time to, the cost is the cost. And that's kind of another reason why, you know, this is so important, where we can kind of showcase not only the population, but the our corporate partners in the community. This is what it costs to build a farm. I mean, some of it is very aesthetic because it's in the city and we can't just do functional things. We got to make sure it looks good. You know, but, you know, to get the master plan, if you see it on our website, www.carolinafarmtrust.org, I mean, it's very impressive and it's going to cost a lot of money.
And when you're done, when it's up and running, when it's functioning, when you're growing and harvesting and all that good stuff, mm-hmm. it's all vegetables. There are very few vegetarians out there, so
right.
I'm one of them.
So it's all vegetables. So what do you do for protein?
So we have, in our master plan, we have two very large coolers, and we're going to be sourcing probably other produce from our rural farm friends that are within 100 miles, but we also have some great protein farm relationships that we'll have that we'll bring all that in. You know, when someone buys a ground beef from Big Oak Farm, for example, and they use that two or three times and then try to go buy ground beef at the grocery store, they're going to see a big difference. They're not going to want it anymore. I mean, the quality is just there, you know, and it's not even a comparable product.
Okay.
So that's kind of the thing where using the urban farm to reinforce our rural farms is really our main agenda that we're having.
So Johnson C. Smith University started something back in 2013 called the Sustainability Village, which integrates academic coursework and research and experiential education opportunities around sustainable development, conservation, community food systems, and one of the components of this is community and aquaponic gardens. Is that food being grown and harvested right now? Has it been for the last several years, and where is it going?
Yes, it has, and we are proud of this initiative. Now, just to give you a background of how we got started, Johnson C. Smith University did a community survey and found that one of the big priorities within the neighborhoods that surround the university is food insecurity. So we invested together with our partners, you know, the Duke Endowment and Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, invested on this space where we can actually, you know, grow, cultivate crops, invite members of the community to learn from us as well, so that they can take this knowledge back to their community gardens.
In fact, did they not approach you and ask you to do some outreach and come out and help them with those gardens?
Oh, yes. Yeah. And we've been doing that since we started. We have a network of community gardens that we work with. And we supply all of the organic seedlings. We emphasize the use of sustainable agricultural practices. You know, this is agriculture that's good for the environment. So at Johnson C. Smith University, what we have is a series of raised beds, which are pretty much our demonstration and research plots. We have an aquaponics facility, and aquaponics is the cultivation of fish and vegetables in one closed loop. Mm-hmm. And we also have a hydroponics facility, a large commercial size hydroponics facility, which we grow lettuce in.
Now, is most of this for research, or is most of this to supply the nutritional needs of people in the surrounding community?
Both.
Okay.
So we are an educational institution. Of course, our students come first. But then we also have a huge mandate to the community that we surround. We've been there for about 150 years now. We're an anchor institution, and we take that with pride. We'd like to see the transformation of that community, and we're very happy to have a new president, President Clarence Ambrister, who has this priority at heart. So all of the produce we grow right now ends up at the farmers market. It's sold at the Charlotte Regional Farmers Market, where our students have a stand. We also partnered with the health department, Mecklenburg County Health Department, to launch the Rosa Parks Farmers Market, which is in its third year now. It runs every Tuesday, like Zach said, between 3 and 7 o'clock. And we are going to try some times.
And where is that?
This is on West Trade Street, 1600 West Trade Street.
And can people living on a fixed income, people who are on that, who are food insecure because of their income, or people who are living in a low-income neighborhood that don't have access to grocery stores, can they afford the food in that farmer's market?
We make it our priority to provide produce that's affordable. Now, how do we do that? One, our pricing is very competitive. In fact, a lot of people that we survey attending the market say that we are quite comparable with, you know, where they actually shop, the grocery stores. But then we also have a program known as Double Up Bucks that the health department started, where people that require supplemental nutritional assistance can actually double their dollars and get twice the amount of produce that they'll get.
If you are part of a generation that has lived in these food deserts for your entire life, uh-huh. and you're now an adult, but your entire background, your entire interaction with food has been the kind of food you get at a convenience store or in a fast food location. Can you change your eating habits? Do you want to change your eating habits? Do you want to incorporate broccoli that you've never had before because that's not a French fry? And I'm oversimplifying here.
Sure.
But do you want to do that? And how do you encourage people to do that? And I know you've talked about cooking demonstrations and showing how to use it, use these pieces of produce, yeah. and how to open your eyes to new food flavors yeah. and opportunities.
So there has to be a value proposition, right? What would you be gaining by changing your habit?
Right.
Would you be gaining, healthier lifestyle? Mm-hmm. Would you be gaining, probably... a few years of life by actually making a change. So yes, I think the value proposition is there, and a lot of people actually decide to make that right decision when they have the knowledge and they have the information to help.
That's another thing where the urban farms are important, Mike, is because no one's going to do something because you told them to do it. But if they see something. Whether it's online or they drive by it and they come down, it's an approach on their level when they're ready. And when they eventually come down and start asking questions, and that might take a year or 2 years, but they have to see it and they got to see, how many people are involved with it and the work, and we have to be proactive. But it has to be a very subtle conversation and not a demanding
if
one.
If the acquisition of healthy food is a burden and a chore on people in lower income levels because of lack of access to grocery stores and the need to take a bus to get there and back, et cetera, then there's the problem also if you have them involved in growing food. Uh-huh. That all takes time. And I was going to ask this question, but I'll let one of our listeners do it. Rebecca on Facebook, nobody is telling Ballantyne to get a community garden. If people are working two jobs and commuting hours to get to them, do you really think they want to go gardening afterwards? They deserve stores just like in other parts of town.
Now, yeah, so that's a misconception. People don't go into community garden necessarily out of necessity. In fact, most of the people we sample actually enjoy it. They want that interaction with their neighbors, and they get the added advantage of getting food brought back home. So, it's not something that we're imposing on the community. This is something that they elect to do and they love to do.
But aren't we asking people who are already burdened, if they are working two jobs and they're traveling by bus to get to those jobs, which takes uh-huh. a long chunk of your day, and probably they have kids that they have to take care of when they get home, mm-hmm. and they have all the things everybody has to do, like laundry sure. and things like that. Are we not just putting another burden on these people?
So I think we are. So that's why land use planning comes in handy. I think land use is very important part of this puzzle, because if we provide access to stores close to the neighborhoods, if we provide solid, smart infrastructure, transportation to get to the store where it does not take 45 minutes.
We give incentives. The county and the city and the state give incentives for football stadiums. Mm-hmm. Why can't we give incentives for Lidl to go in and put a grocery store, make it a tax-free grocery store or something like
in
that?
In fact, we do. Yeah. We have an opportunity zones. So we have west and east parts of our city where there are certain
parts. Where are those stores? They're not there. It's not working.
So opportunity zones is something new that we had just applied for. And that
applied to whom for?
So federal. So it's a federal our program of opportunity zones.
Why does it have to be federal? You have taxation policy in the city and the county. Why can't you just say, if you put your grocery store here, you get to keep the tax? We won't charge you property tax. We won't charge you sales tax.
Absolutely. And I think we have done that in the past.
Where?
And same with Eastland.
Where?
We have done the incentives. However, it's up to the market to take an advantage of that incentive.
So just like the incentives for building affordable housing, no one's taking you up on the offer. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, I think with Eastland redevelopment, I think we will see whether that incentive is going to work or not. Because, for an example, when we started Eastland redevelopment of a year ago, when we had just started the conversations with developers, there was no interest. And now, a year later, because of so much commitment from our city, we have seen interest in bringing development here. But it takes a lot more incentives to bring it up to the market.
And that's what we want to play, Mike, is playing in the market.
Yeah.
The urban farm is workforce development. I know the affordable housing is a very hot topic, but where are those people going to buy their groceries in affordable housing? I mean, that questionnaire from Facebook from Ballantyne, there are people that are food insecure in Ballantyne. Uh-huh. You know, so we have to work with policy and drive action at the same time. And what we're trying to do is get the urban farm up and running and utilize the farm stand there, but also deliver food boxes to people.
Okay.
You know, and that's kind of where the burden is not on them, but on us to make sure that
happens. We are experiencing grocery store wars all over the more affluent parts of Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
What kinds of incentives do grocers want to put a store in a food desert that is easily accessible to people and affordable once they get there?
So ultimately, it comes down to profit margin.
What kind of incentives do they require to have a profit margin that makes it work for them?
I think government plays an important role, but at the end of the day, it's the consumers. So if they cannot get the consumers that they want...
Who do they want?
It's the ones that will pay high prices.
There
is a reason why Whole Foods, Publix, they're all in parts of our city.
You're telling me that this is an unsolvable problem.
No, I think it is a solvable. I think it takes the private sector, it takes the public sector, it takes nonprofit and various community partners like what Zach is doing and what Dr. Oh is doing. It takes all of us to address this problem. Government cannot solve the problem on its own. Just like affordable housing, it takes private developer, it takes the public sector, it takes the incentives and nonprofit.
Yeah,
just the same problem we are seeing
for
with
sure.
Food deserts.
I mean, yeah, Doug and I are in line. I mean, we're taking up the challenge. This is not going to be solved by policy.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked to a lot of people, and the corporations in town have spent thousands and hundreds of thousands of dollars on food access for the last 40 years, have nothing to show for it, really. We have to rise up the challenge and do it through action. And that's what that urban farm is. That's what Sustainability Village is to create action to engage the public.
But when you get that farm up and running,
yes,
how big a dent will you be able to make in this problem?
I think we'll be able to make a very large dent into it because we're not only going to we're going to be very diversified in crop production because we want the residents of East Charlotte to have some input there, but we're also going to be a very good wholesale partner to our rural farms we're going to funnel their production through that farm to meet the demand. We already have a parcel on the west side that we've been offered, but we have to get this one up and running.
Economically, how do you know it's going to work? Are there other examples around the country where this is up and running and does, in fact, work economically for farmers and for residents?
There's a lot of urban farms around the country, nothing of this size. Most of them are doing hydroponics and aquaponics, which we're going to do a large portion of that, but they're very focused on microgreens or lettuce, and it's very much the restaurant market. We got to find that balance of our main priority is to serve everyone up and down the socioeconomic ladder and address food insecurity, food deserts, and getting people engaged.
It starts to make economic sense once you can reduce the cost of at the farm. Now, you know, you've pointed to a very, very important, issue, which is that the odds of food insecurity increase, with the number of miles that you travel to get to your grocery store.
Right.
You know, it increases 2% for every mile you have to travel. So we have to create, public private partnerships to create these spaces where people can actually buy affordable produce.
And I hope you can do that. That you get the last word. Philip Otienoboro, who's director of the Center for Renewable Energy and Sustainability at Johnson C. Smith University, where they operate the Sustainability Village. Zach Wyatt, the director of the Carolina Farm Trust, and Dimple Ajmera, City Councilwoman at Large.